earth as much as possible. All right, Proverbs chapter 10. We've turned a corner in Proverbs, and we are now going to be looking at a, for the remainder of the book, a series of Proverbs that at first glance may seem disjointed a bit and disconnected, but I'm going to do my best to develop some kind of outline and direction as we work through each of these chapters. What we're going to discover is no longer forceful admonitions. You know, Solomon has been saying, listen, my son, you need to do this. You need to think about that. You need to remember this and to seek wisdom. What we're going to see now is a collection of what I'm calling independent, kind of miscellaneous, somewhat pithy observations, dealing mostly with the consequences of right and wrong actions on various topics. There's a frequent change of subject throughout the rest of Proverbs in each chapter, you know, sometimes from one verse to another and sometimes from a group of verses to another group. And that might be a deliberate plan of Solomon so that we are forced to have to look at one proverb and grapple with it before we move on to the next one, which might teach something completely a completely different subject. And we're having to meditate upon the previous thoughts in one place before we get to the subject in another place. And I think the point of these proverbs is that life lived on the ground, on this side of the grave, which is prone to chaos, right? Left to itself, life on the ground, on this side of the grave, just left to itself, is prone to chaos. It takes diligence and wisdom to corral life back into some kind of order. So the point here then with these proverbs is that life lived on the ground prone to chaos, if lived wisely, is one that avoids the bad consequences of a fool and embraces the action of the righteous life. And this is true in every possible dimension of one's life. So Proverbs gives us a series of principles, not promises. There's no guarantee that the principles so enumerated in Proverbs will transpire. A major factor in this, as we go through the rest of the book, is the character of other people. Proverbs, for instance, describes the naive and the fool and the evil man, as well as the wise, the prudent, and the righteous man. So we have these various characters all throughout the book of Proverbs. And they're all personally responsible for who they are and for the character they have, and then the consequences that result from that. You know, like many verses in Proverbs, these are generalizations. For instance, we're going to learn that while diligence is essential for prosperity, as a general principle, diligence does not guarantee prosperity as a promise. Generally, the consequences will characterize the choices of a fool and a wise person. And that's what we're going to learn as we go through these Proverbs. So Proverbs underscores for us the kind of paths one takes in life. And then that path carves out a direction one walks in life, and one can expect certain outcomes and consequences depending on the path that is chosen. Now, what I want you to notice in this chapter is the emphasis on the righteous. Notice with me, just if you'd like to mark your Bible, you can look in verse 2, and it says, "But righteousness delivers from death." Verse 3, "The Lord will not allow the righteous to hunger." Verse 6, "Blessings are on the head of the righteous." Verse 7, "The memory of the righteous is blessed." Verse 11, "The mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life." Verse 16, the wages of the righteous is life. Verse 20, the tongue of the righteous is choice silver. Verse 21, the lips of the righteous feed many. Verse 24, and the desire of the righteous will be granted. Verse 25, the righteous has an everlasting foundation. Verse 28, the hope of the righteous is gladness. Verse 30, the righteous will never be forsaken. Verse 31, the mouth of the righteous flows with wisdom. And verse 32, but the lips of the righteous bring forth what is acceptable. Now, with that emphasis in mind, I'm going to break down the chapter this way. Let's begin here. It seems to me in verse 1 that the rudiments of righteous living is established in the family. The rudiments of righteous living is best established in the family. Notice in verse 1, the Proverbs of Solomon, a wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. Here is a proverb about family relationships. And we're going to bump into this as we go throughout the book, but let me say this about that in this verse. This proverb is about the character of one's child or children. For instance, a wise son or a foolish son. A son or daughter's character affects his or her parents. A child can be wise or foolish. A child can be one that brings gladness or can be one that brings grief. Now, parents have responsibilities to their children. And children have responsibilities to their parents. It's pretty well outlined throughout the scriptures. But neither is responsible for the character of the other. What a parent does affects the growth of their child. What a child does is affects the life of his or her parents. But each one is only responsible for his or her character. Now, bad parents can have good children. Good parents can have bad children. For instance, only a good mother, in this verse, would be grieved by a foolish son. Grief because of badness. Grief because of foolishness. But this assumes goodness on the part of the one who is grieving. Now, let's say that a child chooses to be righteous. Alright? Let's say that a child chooses, as a result of the rudiments of righteous living impacting his or her life, they move out on their own and they choose righteous living, righteous priorities, righteous ambitions, righteous lifestyle, then what can we expect to see? Well, he tells us four things. Verse 2, one of the things we can expect to see is that honesty will have far greater value than cheating, stealing, and hoarding wealth at any cost. He says, ill-gotten gains don't profit, but righteousness delivers from death. We can expect to see, secondly, the understanding that God will provide a spirit of sufficiency, leaving one satisfied with their position in life while avoiding a life of unfulfilled desires, which will never satisfy. He says that in verse 3, the Lord will not allow the righteous to hunger, but he will thrust aside the craving of the wicked. We can expect, thirdly, that instead of refusing to work, disgracing himself or herself or his or her family, notice 4, poor is he who works with a negligent hand, and the end of verse 5, he who sleeps in a harvest is a son who acts shamefully. So instead of refusing to work and bringing disgrace and shame, over time, wealth will be accumulated, seizing opportunities with keen insight at exactly the right time and season. Notice the middle of verse 4, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. And he who gathers in summer is a son who acts wisely. So if a son or daughter, influence in the home to move in a righteous path, does so honesty and sufficiency and diligence will be the outcomes. But there's one other, verse 6. Reward and not ruin will follow the righteous life. It says in verse 6, blessings are on the head of the righteous, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. The righteous person will be guided by his or her righteousness while dodging the aggressive tone and violence that is embraced by the wicked person who can't be trusted. Righteousness is governed by one's head, he says in this verse, while aggression parades through another's mouth. So the point here is that righteous living, characterized by honesty and sufficiency and diligence and enrichment in life, are all standards that become patterns imprinted from the home, embraced by the child, and pursued in life as valuable for his or her extended family. These are foundational to godliness, as Solomon says as he's drinking that cup of coffee, talking to his sons and his daughters. So the rudiments of righteous living is established in the family. But let's take it a step farther. So if one chooses then in life to be righteous, how does that righteous person impact those around him or her? What does that look like? And what is its opposite? Well, there's at least five things. I'm going to tick through these and make some comments. If someone chooses to move in a righteous path, we're going to see, first of all, a good reputation is an outcome of the righteous life. Notice he begins this section of verse 7. The memory of the righteous is blessed, but the name of the wicked will rot. How do you like them apples? Reputation follows both the righteous and the wicked. The word for name here, or the use of the memory of, or the name of the righteous and the name of the wicked, that word name can refer to fame, the reputation, the fame, the memory of someone. In this case, the fame of the righteous will be a memorial, but the fame of the wicked will eventually disappear or remain in people's memory only to be ridiculed. Or people will not be able to forget because of the ridicule it deserves. How can we forget Hitler? As much as we'd like to take his name and put it in the garbage heap of history, we memorialize his name because we can't forget the evil that he accomplished. And there are three ways these reputations are contrasted beginning in verse 8. First, the righteous, the wise, they're teachable and compliant and willing to learn. But the fool just talks too much, needlessly chattering to listen or learn and leading to his or her ruin. Verse 8, the wise of heart will receive commands, the babbling fool will be thrown down. That's one way these reputations are contrasted. Here's the second way, verse 9. The wise have integrity that secures their future, but the cheater with crooked dealings is discovered and ruins his reputation. Verse 9, he who walks in integrity walks securely. He who perverts his ways will be found out. Third, verse 10 tells us that these reputations being contrasted, but those suggesting sinful intentions lead only to trouble for its victims. And it says in verse 10, he who winks the eye causes trouble. That's not a good reputation. And furthermore, he repeats what he said in verse 8, and a babbling fool will be thrown down, just in case we didn't get it the first time. It may be bad to suggest something sinful with the wink of an eye, and you mean something, you know, hidden. You don't want other people to know, but you want to pull it off. But it is doubly a problem and a repeated problem if you are just a foolish, jesting, crass talker. And the point here is, a reputation takes a lifetime to construct. It takes a lot of work and effort to build and to develop. And it can be lost in a weak moment. We benefit from the reputations of the righteous. They leave us a legacy to embrace, and it's sobering that it can be so easily lost with the wink of an eye. And that reputation can be remembered as a negative example. So the righteous have a good reputation. But let's say that they continue to move in a righteous path, and how does that influence the world around them? Well, we learn beginning in verse 11 that what the righteous say is always beneficial and appropriate. And he says in verse 11, the mouth of the righteous, like the memory of the righteous in verse 7, now we have the mouth of the righteous in verse 11, is a fountain of life. Unlike the aggressive violence of the wicked that just stirs up hatred and vitriol, notice what he says at the end of verse 11, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. Verse 12, hatred stirs up strife. You can go that direction. You can go ahead and just destroy people and relationships. But the righteous don't operate that way. The mouth of the righteous is the fountain of life. Look at the end of verse 12. And love covers all transgressions. The righteous love. And that love comes with forgiveness. This doesn't mean that the wrongs are overlooked and ignored. Forgiveness does not ignore the offense, but it doesn't personally seek justice for that offense. It holds no bitterness and seeks no revenge. Verses 13 and 14, with critical perception, the righteous speak wisely, he says. On the lips of the discerning, wisdom is found. They silently store up knowledge for the right moment. Verse 14, wise men store up knowledge, waiting for the precise moment in the situation in which they can share the thoughts that bring life, not death. This is unlike the fool who lacks judgment and constantly needs correction. Look at verse 13b, the second part of it. The rod is for the back of him who lacks understanding. He talks prematurely without thinking through the counsel. It's inappropriate. The end of verse 14, but with the mouth of the foolish, ruin is at hand. Carrying on with this idea of appropriateness, with the idea of wealth and ruin, here is a comparison of one in verse 15 who has not stored up knowledge appropriate for the occasion, but also wealth as a protection, while the fool not only ruins counsel but delivers poverty and adversity. He says in verse 15, the rich man's wealth is his fortress, the ruin of the poor is their poverty. I think the idea here is that one who is inappropriate and never benefiting others is on shaky ground. His or her life will only bring poverty, not just financially, but in many, many, many kinds of ways. And their counsel is not worth hearing. Have you ever listened to someone and you regretted what you listened to? You went and said, "Man, that sounded," and you realize it was just a ruinous counsel. This person didn't even know what they were talking about, and I should have known it by observing their life in the first place. Why did I go to that well? And yet, we've also experienced the opposite with people who have given us the exact appropriate counsel, and a light bulb goes on, and we get direction and perspective we've needed, and we move in that path. Now, everyone needs someone who speaks with integrity, just the right counsel, and delivers words that bring life and preservation. Too many of us have been scarred by bitter and ruinous words. And isn't it interesting that those can come and bubble to the surface immediately? Even though those words were spoken 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago. That's what fools do. They destroy people's lives with their words. But the righteous are not that way. Their words
bring life. They're appropriate. They're beneficial. So if you want to see if righteousness is displayed in your life, Solomon says to his sons, righteous people say what is always beneficial and appropriate. A good reputation is the outcome of the righteous life. But he goes on in verse 16 with his counsel. The return of righteous living is a meaningful life. Notice what he says in verse 16, the wages of the righteous is life. So we have the memory of the righteous is blessed in verse 7. The mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life in verse 11. The wages of the righteous is life in verse 16. Rewards from life are determined by our moral choices. The point seems to be that what one receives in life depends on how he or she uses gifts and righteous character. Now, the wicked will only inherit trouble, by the way, he says. The end of verse 16. The income of the wicked is punishment. It's kind of like if you want to get paid and you want reward and you would like to have a salary and you want remuneration in life, then for the righteous, it's life. For the wicked, it's punishment. They're going to inherit trouble. The word life, by the way, connects verse 16 and 17 because notice, in verse 16, the wages of the righteous is life. Verse 17, he was on the path of life. And so he goes on with this idea about righteous living produces a meaningful life. That's the return. One who is learning from discipline and instruction is an example of the way to a meaningful life. He is on the path of life who heeds instruction. See, it's a basic component of a righteous life. And refusing discipline and instruction is the domain of fools. You know, ignoring correction leads to unfortunate consequences, he says, at the end of verse 17. He who forsakes reproof goes astray. Verses 18 and 19, carrying on with the idea of righteous, the return of righteous living as a meaningful life, we have two fallacies that undermine a meaningful life in verses 18 and 19. The first one is a hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is bad enough. Verse 18. He who conceals hatred has lying lips. But slander is worse, verse 8. And he who spreads slander is a fool. Both are born out of a spirit of hatred. And then there's a third unpleasant consequence, or component, I should say, that gets in the way of a meaningful life, and it's a loose tongue in verse 19. When there are many words, transgression is unavoidable. Oh, how many times have I wished I could have taken those words back? I said a little too much. Excessive talking eventually leads to entanglement. One ends up saying things he or she regrets with uncontrolled speech, yet the ability to remain silent avoids this sinful outcome. Notice the end of verse 19. He who restrains his lips is wise. Thus, room is made in one's speech to enable the meaningful life to be experienced. So, our mouths can cause a lot of trouble. We embellish, we exaggerate, we enhance, we aggrandize, we deceive, we lie, we fabricate. But a meaningful life is often associated with a controlled tongue. And boy, doesn't that connect with the New Testament? James chapter 3 and many other passages. You know, there's a theology of conversation in the New Testament. And it weaves its finger from Corinthians all the way through the New Testament letters. You ought to study sometimes the use of speaking and words and communication in the New Testament. There's a whole theology of conversation. How God expects us to use our words to speak to one another. And Solomon says way back in the Old Testament, Proverbs 10, that the return of righteous living is a meaningful life, which is associated with those kinds of things. Here's the fourth. Two more to go. Verse 20. The righteous share what is valuable and edifying. Notice in verse 20, the tongue of the righteous is choice silver. So we have the memory of the righteous is blessed, verse 7. The mouth of the righteous is the fountain of life, verse 11. The wages of the righteous is life, verse 16, and the tongue of the righteous is choice silver, verse 20. What we learn here in verse 20 and 21 is that righteous counsel accomplishes two things. First, it is uplifting. It's like choice silver. It is infinitely more valuable than the counsel of the wicked, the end of verse 20. The counsel, the words of the wicked, is worth little in comparison. So that's the first thing. Righteous counsel accomplishes two things. First, it's uplifting. Secondly, verse 21, it enhances and nourishes the common life of others. Verse 21 says, the lips of the righteous feed many, but fools die for a lack of understanding. In contrast, fools' lack of judgment only delivers wrong talk. And it's interesting that the word die there is the idea of malnourishment. They malnourish themselves and those listening to their counsel. Here's the point. There's nothing valuable or edifying in what they have to say. In verse 22, here are the ideas that wealth given by the Lord to the righteous and the diligent is not accompanied by trouble. He says here in verse 22, it is the blessing of the Lord that makes rich, and he adds no sorrow to it. This goes back, by the way, to verse 2, where it says, ill-gotten gains do not profit. And the idea here is that when the Lord gives wealth, and he does, and he gives it in all kinds of ways and in all kinds of levels to us, it is never ill-gotten. So it doesn't come with difficulty and hardship. It doesn't come with pain and trouble. And the righteous know the significance of what is valuable about their wealth and what is edifying in the use of it in life, and thus they use it accordingly. We're accountable for whatever God gives us, including our wealth. In verse 23, one's character is revealed in what he or she enjoys. He says, doing wickedness is like sport to a fool. And that reminds me of all of these guys I've told you about before. The Larry Krasinski's in life. The Gary Moore's in life. The Jim Braden's in life. The Rich Reedy's in life, who just have a way of getting under your skin and making you seem small. They make sport of you. They just love to put you in your place or to show their dominance or to make you look weak, to embarrass you and bring shame to you. And he says, that's what it's like for the wicked. They like that. It's sport to them to be derogatory, to bring others down. It's like child's play. It's so easy for them. But the wise, however, prefer wisdom. He says, and so the end of verse 23, and so wisdom is to a man of understanding. That's much greater value. So the righteous share what is valuable and edifying. They're not into making sport of others. The righteous perceive the value of eternal things versus temporal things and driven to give and to provide to others what's in their best interest. And then here's the final point about the impact of righteous living. It delivers a good reputation, for sure. The righteous life is one that shares what is valuable and appropriate and beneficial. The return of righteous living is a meaningful life. The righteous share edifying information. And finally, the prospect of the righteous is confidence in the fear of the Lord. He says this in this way, beginning in verse 24, and the desire of the righteous will be granted. And he connects that in verse 27 to the fear of the Lord. So we have the memory of the righteous is blessed. The mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life. The wages of the righteous is life. The tongue of the righteous is choice silver. And the desire of the righteous will be granted. Well, in 24 to 27, the prospects for the wicked, in contrast, is the realization of their fears. If they aren't going to fear God, then they're going to realize their own fears. And they're often going to receive that which they dread. Verse 24 says, what the wicked fears will come upon him. Many dread calamity, and they receive it without any way to manage it, because the immediate and not the ultimate is only in view. They're not prepared. So when calamity comes, verse 25, when the whirlwind passes, the wicked is no more. They have no foundation to stand upon. Without a fear of the Lord, all they're left with is a fear of their future. But that's not so for the righteous. The righteous has an everlasting foundation. The righteous see the ultimate in view, founded on the fear of God. Now, somebody who is a sluggard, verse 26, is especially frustrating to these kinds of people, to the righteous, because given work to do, a sluggard sees no value in the long term, only the short term. Notice he says in 26, like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is the lazy one to those who send him. A sluggard has no concept of the ultimate. And so a wicked person only lives for the moment as like a sluggard who just doesn't take notice of what the future holds. It's only what's valuable to him or her right at the moment, no matter how it impacts you. It's like vinegar and smoke. They're aggravating to us. Smoke getting in the eyes is not a fun thing. When I want to have a drink of apple juice and I down some vinegar instead, it doesn't taste good. And that's what this guy is like. But only the fear of the Lord provide the kind of protection and prosperity in life that we would want. He says in verse 27, the fear of the Lord prolongs life, but the years of the wicked will be shortened. The hope of the righteous is gladness, but the expectation of the wicked perishes. And so on and so forth. But fearing the Lord is the basis of a joyful fulfillment in life. So notice he says four things to conclude with about fearing the Lord. If the prospect of the righteous life is confidence in the fear of the Lord, where will this be displayed? Well, verse 28, let me just tick them through. He says, fearing the Lord is the basis of the joyful fulfillment of hope, while the wicked's hopes are dashed. Verse 29, fearing the Lord brings security in God's providential administration of life, but proved to be disastrous to the wicked, who have no concept of the fear of God, nor of God's dealings in their life. Verse 29 says, the way of the Lord is stronghold to the upright, but ruin to the workers of iniquity. Third, fearing the Lord is the basis of refuge in His character and His promises. But there's no hope of God's favor and only justice for the unrighteous. Verse 30, the righteous will never be shaken in the fear of God, but the wicked will not dwell in the land. In other words, they'll have no security and no future, but only justice. And finally, fearing the Lord motivates a judicious use of words, of counsel, of advice, of teaching and instruction, which is only appropriate and fitting. He says in verse 31, the mouth of the righteous flows with wisdom. Verse 32, the lips of the righteous bring forth what is acceptable. That's what happens when somebody fears the Lord. But one who doesn't, it's worthless. The end of verse 31, the perverted tongue will be cut out and the mouth of the wicked, what is that is perverted, will be cut out. So, what do we conclude here? Well, the fear of the Lord should impact the very words and the very counsel we give, the teaching we provide, the advice that we share. Proverbs teaches, if anything, that good people use few words and choose them well. So, the memory of the righteous is blessed. It's a good reputation. Verse 11, the mouth of the righteous is the fountain of life. They share what is appropriate. The wages of the righteous is life. There's a meaningful life for the righteous. The tongue of the righteous is choice silver. What the counsel they give is beneficial and valuable. And then finally, the desire of the righteous will be granted. And the outcome here is confidence in the fear of the Lord. So Solomon begins the chapter by saying to his sons, a wise son makes a father glad. A foolish son is a grief to his mother. Now, as we think through this chapter and as we consider the righteous life, let me encourage you to do two things. Number one, evaluate your own life according to this standard. How do you measure up? What's the reputation you have? Do you share words that are appropriate? Are they do you have counsel that's beneficial? Are you living a meaningful life? And so on. Evaluate your life according to these, but also measure your ministry according to these. Is this what you are able to instill and bring into the life of others in the ministry God has given you? Our gracious Father, there is a lot here for us to grapple with. It's pretty clear to me that you desire that your people live a righteous life. And that you've enumerated specific ways that is demonstrated. Some of these things are long-term. Building a reputation, a good reputation, doesn't happen overnight. And so you expect the righteous to have staying power. And to move across the spectrum of life, building this kind of thing. And Lord, as we reflect upon these, we desire to be men and women that demonstrate this kind of righteous life and take these proverbs seriously and bring them into the scope of our own lives and relationships. Strengthen us to that end, and may we reflect more and more of these proverbs in the way that we live and serve, share, and give. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.